Good day, and welcome to the Patently Strategic Podcast, where we discuss all things at the intersection of business, technology, and patents. This podcast is a monthly discussion amongst experts in the field of patenting. It is for inventors, founders, and IP professionals alike, established or aspiring. And in today's episode, we're looking at one man's efforts to immortalize the pioneering genius of African-American inventors from the past 400 years. Our special guest today is James Howard, founder and executive director of the Black Inventors Hall of Fame. James Howard is a college professor, design historian, entrepreneur, industrial designer, inventor, filmmaker, and restaurateur. He brings over 25 years of experience as a design professor and has authored a course on design thinking and design history that explores the impact of design on society. As an accomplished industrial design educator and entrepreneur, Howard has lectured on the experience of Black American inventors. Howard himself is an extraordinary inventor with 20 patents, several of which we discuss cover innovations that save people's lives daily. James' life work is now culminating in his mission of bringing a broad and detailed awareness to the important work of African-American inventors, artists, and innovators who have inspired and forged ahead against tremendous odds and adversity. In creating the Black Inventors Hall of Fame, James hopes to have a place where kids of all ages and persuasions can go and be inspired to become the next generation of great scientists, engineers, doctors, and inventors. Because like the great inventor Lonnie Johnson says, what they see, they will be. James and I cover a wide range of topics, including his origin story as an inventor and how his inventions are inspiring his grandkids now on their own innovation journey, the genesis and motivation for the Black Inventors Hall of Fame, what advice he'd give to those newer to inventing, his biggest learnings from the greats featured in his Black Inventors Got Game documentary, what we should be doing to support and inspire today's youth and the next generation of inventors. And especially in honor of Black History Month, we discuss some Black inventors whose inventions help shape daily life, but aren't yet household names. James is working diligently to change that. Now, before jumping in with James, we'd like to take you to the next installment of the Mossoff Minute, a monthly segment that features short conversations with Professor Adam Mossoff, providing updates and quick takes on movements in patent reform, significant court rulings, innovation policy happenings, and occasional Star Wars references. In this month's Minute, Adam discusses how there's a pirate living in your Apple Watch and why the media's coverage of Apple's predatory infringement of Massimo's patents is missing the mark.
Now, the Massimo one kind of continues because it continues to be an example of, you know, predatory infringement with everything that Apple is doing. It's really frustrating because no one is, in all of the news reports on this, like, oh, Apple's going to pull their Apple Watches from, you know, from Christmas shopping. You don't see actually in the reporting Apple has been found to infringe. And in fact, they engaged in predatory infringement. They've got information on Massimo's technology from licensing negotiations. They hired Massimo engineers. They are an infringer. They are an adjudged infringer. They challenged the validity of the patents, and they were, and the patents were upheld, even at the PTAB. They have been found to engage in invention theft. And any company, you know, that has a moral compass would then say, all right, we should pay a license. But instead, they continue to fight this. They continue to engage in PR games. And then their position is, well, if, and then we're just going to take our toys and go home. Well, first of all, you're still going to pay damages for all of all, you know, no one's talking about this. They still have to pay damages for, even if they pull it from their watches going forward, because they stole a patent. We don't say to someone who like squats, like, oh, you've chosen not to squat anymore, so we're just going to forgive you for the last 10 years of your squatting. You know, every story should lead off with Apple was found to have violated a valid patent. It repeatedly challenged the validity of this patent. Its challenges were rejected. It was found to be an infringer. It's the baseline for any discussions going forward about what they're doing. They are not the good actor in the situation. They are a thief. And anyway, so that's kind of one of the things I'm all riled up about.
I always tell people, it's like, okay, when you watch the news and you got the anchor person there and there's that little graphic that goes up alongside of them, it's like they're telling you the story. They're trying to put your brain in a mode right then, and everything that they say is just, that's like creating this ramp into your head, you know? It's the framing, it's the context, and that's 1,000% what's going on with all of these Apple stories, yeah, right? It's turning Massimo into the bad guy of, oh, they're trying to take, you know, your Apple Watch away, instead of like Apple's asking for special permission to keep stealing. Like, what?
Yeah. Like, please, you know, federal circuit, and eventually Supreme Court, because they're gonna appeal this all at the Supreme Court, right? Oh, please, order the injunction or the exclusion order to be stayed so that we can keep stealing.
Yeah, because society cannot live without their Apple Watch.
Yeah, and not just their Apple Watch. Like, society can't live without their little, blood oxygen pulse technology sensor in the Apple Watch. And that's the other thing too. Like, they have engaged in such duplicitous, two-faced argumentation, right? Because their first position was, oh, we can't design around it. We can't pull this out of the Apple Watch. So the entire Apple Watch goes down if you issue the exclusion order. And that's even why they threatened to pull their watches, right, from pre-Christmas sales, which again, all PR, because they have $250 billion of cash in the bank. So it's like not like they're going to be hurt by this. Yeah. Now, all of a sudden, they're like, oh, actually, we have submitted a design around for review by this other agency that is apparently that everyone forgot has authority over these topics. It's like, oh, well, why didn't you do that in the first place then?
Yeah. Well, just because you can't design around also is not a roadblock. That's where get a license.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly. This is Kodak versus or Polaroid versus Kodak all over again, right? Because this is exactly what Kodak argued when it was finally found to have been an infringer after dragging Polaroid through 12 years of litigation, and Polaroid finally got their judgment. Finally got their injunction, and they went and Kodak went crying to the Federal Circuit and said, oh, woe is us. We've employed 80,000 employees. We've spent hundreds of millions of dollars. And the Federal Circuit said, yeah, you chose to infringe. That was the gamble that you took.
Right.
Right. So, you don't get to now, use the economic benefits that have accrued to you and to others as a result of your infringement as the reason for why you should be allowed to continue to steal. In any other context, if we said someone is punching you in the face and they're like, oh, well, I've gotten really strong and I continue to get stronger punching you in the face. It's a good exercise for me. My doctor tells me I have to keep doing exercise. I have to keep letting me punch you in the face as a result of this. We would say this is insane. But in the patent policy space and in the reporting on this, the people are like, oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, that makes sense.
but strip the layers of it back. And it's like if the story was, oh, somebody went into a bank, robbed the bank, stole $1 million, built a business empire around that $1 million, employed tons of people and created a whole bunch of products. Well, I guess we should just, look past the fact that you robbed a bank for $1 million. No, like that's not the way the system works. That's not the society we live in. But for some reason, when we wrap it up and package it a little bit different around intellectual property theft, everybody's like, oh yeah, but I gotta have my Apple Watch at Christmas. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, not exactly.
Thanks, Adam. We're also publishing clips from the Mossoff Minute as short form videos on Instagram Reels, YouTube Shorts, and TikTok. You can check out these shorts and follow us at Aurora Patents on all three platforms. And now, without further ado, here's our conversation with James Howard.
Welcome, James, and thanks for carving out some time from a no doubt busy schedule to chat with us.
Thank you. It is my absolute pleasure to be joining you, Josh.
Yeah, it's just going through the list: professor, historian, entrepreneur, industrial designer, inventor, restaurateur. Really glad that there's an opportunity in there for podcast guest as well too, because that sounds like quite a schedule. So the first question, I sort of like to do things kind of chronologically sometimes. We've got a lot of inventors in the audience. Could you tell us a little bit about your origin story as an inventor?
Sure. Well, it kind of begins with my very first job right out of grad school. I went to work for a company that is the leading manufacturer of ADL equipment, that is AIDS for Daily Living. And in that experience was the opportunity to often meet with individuals who were inventing gadgets and products to help to aid their loved ones, reaching AIDS, feeding AIDS, dressing AIDS, things of that nature. So I had a chance to work directly with these individuals, and the company would often buy the idea and then get a patent on it. So I would have to turn that idea, that raw idea, into a manageable, you know, product, and then translate that into a patent. So my first 7 or 8 patents were all in the field of ADA, AIDS for daily living, and everything from spoon AIDS that aid you in self-feeding to reading AIDS that aid you in turning pages with your head automatically, and things of that nature. So that was my entree into invention. And then from there, I decided that I needed to open up my own design firm because I wanted to expand my horizons. So I went into starting Howard Design in 1987. And from there, opened up a whole world of opportunity for invention. In fact, one of my very first inventions under the moniker of Howard Design was a neonatal pressure relief valve, which went on to become one of the leading pressure relief valves of its kind in the entire world. And it was the first pressure relief valve that was single use disposable. So that means every single time that you use this valve on a child to resuscitate an infant at birth, you would just throw the valve away. And unfortunately, when I learned of this opportunity, the company had mentioned to me, Vital Signs, had mentioned to me that prior to this particular invention, every valve that was ever made was made of high precision stainless steel. And each and every time they would have to use one of these valves in the emergency setting, they would then have to send it down to get it sterilized, right? So I learned, Josh, of horror stories where just when the valve was needed most, there were none available. They were all being sterilized. And so doctors and nurses, practitioners would have to literally hand prime the pump. And unfortunately, with infants, particularly preemies, if you hand prime the pump too much, you can collapse the lungs. Yeah. And if you don't open up enough airways of oxygen, then you can make the brain deprived of oxygen, and you can have brain deficiencies and so forth. So this valve was absolutely critical.
Yeah, that's just, I mean, it's just an amazing story, you know, just of how inventions, you know, really run the gamut of things that impact our daily lives, you know, in such profound ways. And, you know, I mean, something like that's especially so, because like you said, I mean, that's such an urgent situation. You don't have time to wait for something to come back from cleaning. So it's just, that's remarkable. And, you know, it has to be, I don't know, it has to be very gratifying to sort of even just think about the number of lives that, you know, you positively impacted, with that. So it's very, very cool.
Thank you. Thank you. From there, I also went on to design a whole host and get patents on cardiovascular delivery systems, everything from stent crimping devices responsible for crimping a stent onto a balloon catheter to a septal closure device responsible for closing up holes in infants' hearts. So it has just run the whole gamut. And it kind of falls in line with my basic philosophy, my mission in life, and that is to serve others. And I figured if God's going to give me the talent to be creative and to do these innovative types of outputs, that it should have more of a slant of serving others as opposed to self-gratification and so forth.
Absolutely. So we, you know, we sort of crossed paths originally at the U.S. Inventor Conference. You also told I thought was a really great story about your granddaughter, I believe it was, and a lock that you had invented. Could you tell us a little bit about that one too?
Yeah, it was actually pretty neat. It was not this past Thanksgiving, but the prior one in 2022. And we had done right after eating dinner at my daughter's house in Pennsylvania, I decided to take my grandkids to the local Barnes & Noble to buy them their first Christmas gift for the season, right? This is Black Friday. And while we're there in the toy section and the learning, you know, kids section and all of that, I look over to the right and I happen to see one of my patented products, right? An access control lock that I did for a company of Alarm Lock. And it happened to be the first access control lock in the country that actually had a mechanical override. So just in case the power went down and everything, you can just push the buttons and it actuated mechanically and so forth and was battery operated. Anyway, so I see the lock and I see my three grandkids and I make a connection. I look to my right, there's the lock on the door. I look to my left, there are my three grandkids flocking over toys. So I call them all over to the door and I say, look, guys, this is a great moment. I'd like for you to stand right here and take a look. And I took a picture. Now, my granddaughter up until that point didn't even know that granddad was an inventor. My youngest granddaughter had no clue what an inventor was. Uh-huh. But my oldest grandson, Aiden, he goes with me everywhere. And he has seen this lock a million times. So as I'm gathering them all around the lock, he's going, oh, granddad, not again, right? So take the picture. I purchase, you know, all the toys for them and everything. But right there in that moment, my granddaughter, my oldest granddaughter, started saying, granddad, granddad, what does an inventor do? What do they do? How do they invent? You know, do they get rich? You know, how do they do it? How do they do it? And so I started explaining to her right there in the moment. I said, listen, you got to begin with research. She goes, well, can I invent a toy? I say, yes, you can if you put your mind to it. She says, how do I do it? How do I do it? Mm-hmm. I say, well, you start research. So they started researching. They started going to this shelf and that shelf and looking at the details and asking questions. How would I improve it? So forth. And then we left. We got in the car. It's about a 20-minute ride back to the house. And during that entire 20 minutes, my granddaughter is grilling me on what it takes to be an inventor, right? What it takes to be an inventor. And by the time we get home, that's all she wants to do. So naturally, her younger sister joined on board and my reluctant, adamant grandson came aboard. And they spent the rest of the evening inventing a product. And if you don't mind, I'd like to go right over to the table and show it to you.
Yeah, please do. Yeah, absolutely.
Take 2 seconds.
Sure.
They ended up spending the rest of the day inventing Slap Happy. My grandkids right there.
Oh, that's great.
The tagline says, the childhood game that explodes with excitement. And what it does is really clever. You just have a stack of cards in the middle of the floor. And when you flip them over and a match occurs, the first person to slap down on those cards get that set.
All right.
And then we factored in other components. It just makes it so intriguing. And so right now we're trying to put that on a pathway. But I'm using it more as a learning experience for them.
Sure.
Right? So I'll be entering them into a pitch competition. Can you imagine that? An 11-year-old and a 9-year-old pitching Slap Happy, right? Just an amazing.
I mean, it's so neat, too, for them, too. You know, and this is something you saw earlier on in your career of, you know, sort of like idea to commercialization and really, you know, seeing that end-to-end. You know, is very, very, very empowering. But you know, the whole thing's a wonderful story. I think that the part that I love so much about it, and that just really gravitated to when you're talking about a US inventor is just like what a moment of inspiration sort of that was in, you know, in a child's life. You know, I mean that could be like a life defining moment, and to make sort of what you had done tangible, you know, in that way. And I wasn't even going to talk about this until later, but I watched your, we'll talk more about this in a little bit, but I watched your, you know, Black Inventors Got Game, documentary, you know, this morning. And, you know, Lonnie Johnson had this great quote. I wrote it down. I loved it. He said, you know, what they see, they will be. And yep. And it was like what happened there with the lock and everything that ensued, you know, up to the board game and where they are today is, you know, an absolute real world manifestation, you know, of that. So just a wonderful story.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. And this is why it's so important for us as adults to serve as mentors and do just as much of a job of listening to our kids, you know, as opposed to lecturing to them and advising them.
Yeah.
Listen to what motivates them. Listen to what they really, you know, are passionate about and concerned about. And like with my granddaughter, Kara, it only took that one little spark of curiosity to send her on that pathway.
Yeah.
And I'll add this antidote. She was so driven by this whole world of invention that she started researching other Black innovators of the past. And she stumbled upon this one particular innovator by the name of Alice Ball.
Okay.
And Alice Ball's story is somewhat sad because it started with her inventing a method for eradicating, for managing leprosy. And so her delivery system was the first effective way to manage leprosy. This was in the early 1900s. And while she's in grad school and she's patenting and getting all of her work done in this process called the Ball Method, you know, she's been very successful. She's been applauded and lauded and everything. And suddenly, unfortunately, she has an incident in the lab and she dies a year after inventing this Ball Method, right? So upon her death, the head of the school decided to take full credit for her work and renamed the method the Dean Method. And for over 100 years, the Dean Method had been credited with the work of Alice Ball. And just recently, within the last couple of years, the University of Hawaii has set the record straight and has given her all of her due diligence and claim to being the pioneer for managing this dreadful disease.
Yeah.
So again, it only takes that one spark of inspiration, then you start researching. And Josh, plain and simply, this is why my mission is so important, you know, to have a place where kids of all persuasions and ages can just go and be inspired, you know, to become the next great scientists and doctors and engineers.
I suspected this was going to be a good segue to that next question. So I mean, you founded the Black Inventors Hall of Fame. What were your drivers for that? What's your mission, your goals? What are you hoping to accomplish?
Well, you know, interesting enough, the catalyst was me constantly seeing our story being suppressed, and that's not hyperbole. It has truly been suppressed, and 28 days of the month of the year. Once a year just isn't enough, right, to give full justification to that storyline. And so the real true catalyst was one day I was in the supermarket looking through a Time magazine special article called America's Top 100 Inventors, right? And they cover the whole arc from day one all the way up until 2016, our top 100 inventors. So they have on the front cover, they have Thomas Edison, they have Elisha Gray, they have Alexander Graham Bell, they have Henry Ford, heck, they even had Steve Jobs on there, right? And all of these faces, and I'm saying, wait a minute, I don't see a single Black face on there. So I'm okay with that, Josh, but I decided that I'm going to open it up, and okay, at least I'll see, you know, a couple in there, right? Not a single one, nada, zero. And that kind of stayed with me, Josh, for 4 years. That stayed with me, it stuck with me. And it bothered me. I'm not going to kid you. So the catalyst was one night I am looking at on the computer. This is during COVID when we were all, you know, in the homes. And I'm looking at the grand opening of the National Museum of African American History and Culture. I'm looking at that grand opening, which was on the lawn in Washington, D.C.
Yep.
And Obama was in office. And so they had all of these celebrities and notorieties and government officials come and praise the museum and so forth and so forth. And for 3 full hours, there's storyline and storyline about acknowledging our enslaved past, acknowledging our civil rights past, acknowledging our sports past and our entertainment past. Not a single word mentioned about our illustrious innovation. An inventive past. Sure. Not a one. I was determined that night to do something about that.
Yeah.
And it just so happened, Josh, I was being interviewed just like this.
Yep.
I was being interviewed by a gentleman by the name of Daryl Caldwell. And at the end of the interview, Daryl had asked me, he says, you know what, Mr. Howard, you know so much about African-American inventor history and so much about this and so much about that. He says, have you ever thought about opening up a Black Inventors Hall of Fame? And those words just resonated, man. Three months later, we were opening up. So that's the total origin of Black Inventors Hall of Fame. And now we're on the destiny to open up the first and only museum in the country dedicated exclusively to immortalizing pioneering genius of African-American inventors for the past 400 years.
Yeah, it's great. And it's, you know, what you noticed, I think, little you know, commentary for me, I guess, but was a huge opportunity, a huge missed opportunity, I think, for, you know, for others, especially in an opportunity to celebrate that convergence, like with the accessibility of the patent system. You know, so I mean, like, we're obviously very biased. We love patents, but one of the things that we really, really love about patents is, you know, we started digging more and more into the, you know, the historical roots of these things. And mm-hmm. one of the things that jumps off from the earliest pages is the accessibility of the system. Like the, you know, the 1790 Patent Act, you know, talked about, you know, granting exclusive rights to inventors, and they said, you know, he, she, and they, and didn't explicitly, you know, exclude minorities, people of color, or anything. At a time when women and people of color couldn't vote, couldn't own property, here was this mm-hmm. patent system that mm-hmm. was you know, accessible to all in ways that tragically, unfortunately, other things at the time were not. And yeah. so there's a really interesting convergence of things here that's really worth calling out and celebrating.
Well, it's interesting you would state that. I want to double down on that a little bit and make note to the audience that, yes, you are correct. The accessibility was there. But unfortunately, during that time, slaves were not allowed to attain patents because they were not considered citizens. So those who did, in fact, that are of African-American persuasion, who did attain patents were freedmen. In fact, the very first Black man to ever achieve a patent was Thomas Jennings in 1821 because he was a freedman. He was up in New York and he invented dry cleaning. He invented dry cleaning. But the paper trail is very thin on all those others who were denied patents. And the most noted story I'll tell you very briefly is that of Benjamin Montgomery, who was enslaved to Joseph Davis. And Joseph is the brother of Jefferson Davis. And Benjamin Montgomery designed and improved a steam propeller that helped to revolutionize that industry at the time, literally. Uh-huh. And it was so effective that when he was denied his patent because he was a slave, Joseph Davis attempted to patent it. And even the patent office said no to that because, again, it was originated by a slave. So, you know, those storylines are steep and rich, and it's my job to try to go and uncover more of those so that we can complete the entire story arc. Do you realize the very first African-American woman to ever receive a patent didn't even sign her name in her name? She signed it with an X. She signed it with an X. Her name was Judy Reed.
Okay.
And she got a patent on a knee doler that kneads dough, a mechanical knead doler.
Yep.
And when she signed it with an X, it has been determined by many pundits that the reason she signed it with an X was because she was illiterate. However, I also seem to think that there's a great chance she signed it with an X was because if she had intended on receiving franchise from this dough kneadler, mm-hmm. that if it had been known that the product had come and been invented by a colored woman or a Black woman, it may not have been well received by its audience, right?
Right.
And we know that to be a fact because Ellen Eglin, who had invented a clothes wringer that revolutionized the laundry industry at that time, she was a domestic servant from Washington, D.C., she invented this clothes wringer and sold it for $18. $18 to a white agent. He went on to make riches from it by selling it to the licensing of it to three other manufacturers. And Ellen Eglin got $18. Fast forward 10 years later, when she's been interviewed by a women's magazine called Women Innovators, she says this, and I quote, they asked her, why did you sell your ringer for just $18 when it made so much money? And she goes, well, you know that I'm black. She says, and if it had been known that a colored woman had invented this product, white women would not have purchased it. That is why I sold it for $18. So that's just an example of our story and why these stories are so important to connect and get out to the public so that, you know, future generations of innovators can be inspired by their perseverance.
Yep, absolutely. And I want to go, you know, even a little bit deeper on that if we could. So, you know, a new format that we've started in the podcast centers around inventor stories, you know, which is something that we've absolutely loved doing. We've gotten really great feedback on it. Since it's Black History Month, and since I cannot imagine a better person to ask this question than the man trying to shine more light on the very important aspects of that history, could you tell us about a couple of inventors that impact daily life, but, you know, whose inventors are just not yet household names?
You know, yes, I can. But I'd like to begin with one who is tangibly connected to something that we do daily as we travel. And that is, as you go to airports, and you hop on a plane, and you hop off of a plane. Well, as you know, the airplane was pretty much initiated at the turn of the century when much of the world had its eyes on taking flight. It wasn't just here in this country. Other parts of the world were racing to get patents on taking flight. And as you know, the Wright brothers were working towards that as well. But a little known fact is that there is a black man by the name of Charles Frederick Page, who was born into slavery, was self-taught, raised 11 kids, and he was a carpenter by trade, raised 11 kids. Well, he had joined that race, and he had sought to seek franchise from a competition that was going on in Louisiana, not St. Louis, actually, but it was the Louisiana Exposition. So he designed and built an airship and patented it. And he received his patent 1 month before the Wright brothers received their patent.
No kidding.
But yet you never hear of Charles Frederick Page. It's one of the original aviation pioneers. So what I try to tell people in my community is don't go around saying a black man invented airplanes. That's not the point. That's not the story. No one would ever claim that. What we're claiming is that when we're talking about aviation pioneers in this country, that he needs to be part of the discussion.
Sure. Absolutely.
His patent preceded the Wright brothers' patent by 1 month. And Josh, I'm going to be building a full-size replica of his airship and having it on display at the museum, at the Black Inventors Hall of Fame Museum. I'm working closely with the family. There's only one person still on the face of this earth that was actually around before he died. And this is his cousin. And this guy was 10 years old at the time when Charles Frederick Page died. And so we're interviewing him and we're going to get that story out. Charles Frederick Page, the unknown aviation pioneer. So that's one example. But another example, for instance, on the flip side of that, is the work of Dr. Hedaya Nicole Green. And Dr. Hedaya Nicole Green has a patent on a nanotechnology for eradicating cancer that few in the world in the medical community knows about, right? And you and I both know the ravages of cancer. It is just something that someday the innovative genius of all mankind is going to venture to get to a point of eradicating said cancer. Well, Dr. Nicole Hedaya Green is on the precipice of doing just that, yet she is struggling for getting the proper financing she needs. She took the route of Elijah J. McCoy, and Granville T. Woods, and Henry Boyd, all prior African-American inventors of the past during the golden era. And that is when no one wants to sort of like invest in you, you invest in yourself. So sure. she started her own research facility and is really about to do some amazing things in that area. So you got aviation and you have cancer. I can't think of any more important things that impacts our lives on a daily basis, you know, than those two things. And it's just amazing to me. The things that we've accomplished that just have gone unknown.
Well, I mean, that's something we're, you know, we're happy to, more than happy to raise, you know, awareness around. You know, I was actually just having a conversation with somebody about this the other day. You know, there's things that sort of we take for granted in our daily life because they're problems that were solved by past generations, and we never felt the pain of these things. We were kind of just born into the convenience of the solution. And there are a lot of things that don't kill people anymore because we have medical solutions for them. And it seems, you know, in retrospect, like a silly way to die. And that's one of my biggest hopes, if not my biggest hope for the future, is that at some point in our lives, or at minimum in my kids' lives, that they're going to be able to look back and have that conversation about cancer, right? Like, tragic that people don't have to die that way anymore. Yeah. And that they can get to the point of taking whatever that treatment is, nanotechnology, like that they can start taking it for granted in the way that we take so many of these innovations for granted that, you know, that make our lives so much better.
So well spoken. So well spoken. And that moment's going to come, Josh.
Yeah.
It's absolutely going to come.
Yep. Well, we applaud our efforts and happy to do anything we can to help get the word out.
Thank you.
Next question. So, you know, I know you're working with some very inspiring young inventors. You'd brought a gentleman by the name of Nathaniel Smith with you to the conference the U.S. Inventor Conference. And we've chatted with him since. Incredibly impressive young man. Drawing from both, you know, your experiences as a successful inventor and now as a mentor of the next generation of inventors, you know, what advice would you give to those dreaming to change the world, but perhaps struggling to get that initial, so important foothold?
My advice would be to borrow from the lessons of the past, borrow from the perseverance that Elijah J. McCoy showed when he tried time and time again to sell his lubricating cup to people and no one wanted to buy it, yet they knocked it off anyway. You know, borrow from that level of perseverance, and whatever you do, don't let anyone change your trajectory. Set in your mind that you are going to achieve and just keep moving forward, And there's this old adage in my space of design thinking, Josh, that says, if you are going to fail, if you are going to fall forward, right? And if you're going to fail, embrace failure as learning. So I would encourage all of these young aspiring innovators to embrace failure as learning. So to take every step of that, right, and factor that in to learn how to sort of re-navigate, reboot, and go back at it. But whatever you do, don't let anyone change your trajectory. And I'll close with the advice of the old great soulful singing legend, John Legend. He advises kids that when you hear no, take it as no for now. No for now. So
that's wonderful. That always listening to your internal compass is huge. So I'm reading a book right now. It's called The Hidden Habits of Genius, and it explores attributes of genius over the centuries. And I don't have this quote exactly right, but the essence of it's there. Pablo Picasso's parents were supportive of his art, but not the manifestation of his art. So his father was very, very, very strict about how he painted. And and he said, your painting needs to be more realistic. It needs to be more lifelike. And he got that beat into his head. And so as an adult, he said, that he spent his entire childhood learning how to paint like an adult, and he spent his entire adulthood trying to learn how to paint like a child.
Yeah.
Right? And so, you know, sometimes you're born into a supportive environment that says, oh yeah, maybe this kid's onto something different. And sometimes, mm-hmm. and sometimes you're not, but like, you know, hold true. If that inner compass is pointing strongly in a direction, like, do not be easily deterred.
Don't be deterred. No, Picasso held true, and he got his greatest fulfillment in that latter part of his life, where he was exploring his inner self and following that compass, you know, that led him to the discovery. He's one of the greatest painters of all time. So,
yeah. I love that. I love that. Love that story. Well, it's just so much of genius is not recognized by the immediate peer group surrounding the genius either, right?
I often tell kids that when you have a great idea, oftentimes you find yourself being a minority of one, because people don't always get it. Don't expect the folks to always get it, you know, and that's the sign of true genius.
Yeah. Yeah,
where you are sort of, you know, that lone genius in some respects, because the others just don't get it. But don't let that deter you, and just keep moving forward. And I tell you, there's so much hope and promise right now for today's youth.
Yeah,
this is why I'm leading research right now in STEM education. I'll be heading up a STEM summit in the late fall of this year that will bring together all the significant STEMpreneurs of color in this entire country. We're going to come together in Washington, D.C. and have a summit to discuss just that, you know, some of the best practices of how to reach these kids, how to reach all kids, with a specific focus on underserved youth, and how to put together curricula and programs and talking points that are really going to just, you know, make a difference and make the greatest and pay the greatest, you know, return on investment. So, that's going to take place in the fall of this year. Let you know the date, in fact. And if you want to come and take a few talking heads for that, man, you'd be more than welcome.
Oh, please do. I think it's so important. And, you know, it's an interesting intersection of this generation being born at a time when the technology is so much more accessible now than what it used to be. And engaging, like, you know, like I work on like a lot of robotics kits and stuff with, you know, with our son and our, you know, and our daughter. And like, these are things that we can literally go to our public library and check out for a couple of weeks and play with on their iPad using like drag and drop blocks of, you know, code and little Lego robots and stuff. It's like, I can't wait to see what that gives rise to from the generation that's like, it's going to be so equipped, you know.
Well, you know, interesting enough, we're seeing some samplings of that right now in real time.
Yeah.
You know, the young man, just a month or two back, he was anointed the Young Scientist of the Year Award. He's 14 years old. You hear about this young man's story? 14 years old, and he designed and patented a bacterial soap that fights, can't remember exactly what it fights, but it does a serious job. And he has a patent on it. And the science industry just anointed him the Young Scientist of the Year, 14 years old. I got to reach out to this young man and get him featured on my website. And then we have such young men like this. This young man here is Dejon Strickland. Okay. I met him a couple of years ago while doing my big tour in Kansas City. He was only 12 at the time. And this young man impressed me so much with the line of questions that he had at the end of the talk. He went on to develop his own book called Tech Boy, right? So this talks about kids growing up and learning how to do things with technology that's going to help improve people's lives. And you know what Dejon is doing now? He has started his own missionary work of providing lunches to the kids in the neighborhood who don't have enough money to eat regular nutritious meals each day in school. So he's just a remarkable gentleman, but that is a young man who's inspired by innovation, but further inspired to channel that energy into doing something now. And you know that old adage about go to school, get a good job, go to college. When you graduate, you know, you start doing something. Today's kids are saying, why do I have to wait? I can contribute now. And your kids can contribute now. My granddaughter and grandsons can
contributing now. Yep.
And this is their moment. It is truly their moment.
We will get it. Is that book available for purchase?
Yes, it is.
Okay, good. I will. I'll make sure to get a link to that in the show notes and our write up on the watchdog for this.
Too. Boy, he's a remarkable young man. Absolutely remarkable young man, DeJean Strickland.
That's fantastic. Maybe we need to consider doing like a young inventors episode sometime.
I can help direct you to a couple, man, that would just knock your socks off across the board. These young kids, they're doing some amazing work. They really are. Another conference I'm sitting in on in August, in fact, at the same spot where I first met you, is InventEd. I'm going to be one of the panelists in a special session on just that. You know, where are present day, you know, generators of the next generation of innovators, you know, mm-hmm. And we're not even talking DeJean's age. We're talking my granddaughter's age and her sister's age. Yeah. You know, how can we fuel them? How can we encourage them and just set them on a pathway that even if they don't necessarily stay within the field of innovation, they have adopted certain attributes and skill sets, right? That would just be a positive role model in all endeavors of life, right? Yeah. And I just think innovation and creative thinking and the ability to solve problems and identify problems, all of that is part of the equation that I believe the next generation is going to do probably a slightly better job than we've done.
Well, yeah, because I mean, there's a positive contagiousness to that there's a huge psychological component to it. I think especially with kids, it never really ends regardless of the age group, but especially with kids, it's like, you know, you see the firstborn, they're kind of having to figure everything out on their own. And maybe they don't have a lot of other kids around, but then like, you know, the kids that follow, they see other people that are pretty close to their age and size doing these things. And so, you know, they're sort of driven to do them even sooner because it feels safer. It's more approachable, right? Like I see someone more like me, you know, doing it. And so, you know, the exponential effects that could have like on a societal scale are just, you know, it's really cool. Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. So next question, you know, patent focus. Patents are our focus. You have 20 of them. I'd love to ask how they have helped on your journey.
On my journey, as looking back, particularly starting now and then looking back, I get nothing but great fulfillment when I'm with my grandkids, as exemplified in my prior story, and I'm able to show them and point to a wall, paper towel dispenser that's in most Dunkin' Donuts across the country that granddad has a patent on, access control lock. So being able to tell those stories immediately to my grandkids are great. But then you get further fulfillment when you know that there are some products out there, though they've been retooled and improved and all of that, they set that industry on a pathway, right? For just better and more superior types of delivery systems that can help continue to save people. But at the same time, that journey hasn't always been smooth and fulfilling. And I want to share with the audience one brief story about how a product that I got a patent on for a design patent on for a lollipop blow dryer, it was actually taken and stolen and given credit to a white design firm that told the engineering company that I was an imposter, that I did not invent the product, right? So can you imagine having your competitors tell someone that you're trying to hit up for a contract. And this company is called Dranitz. It was an electrical engineering company. We were on the verge of signing a huge contract. It was in excess of $100,000 to design a line of electrical gadgetry and what have you. And the director who was working with me, the director of engineering, he calls me up one day, with the contract in hand, by the way, just hadn't been signed. He calls them and he goes, James, I'm sorry, man, we're going to back off. We're going to back off with this. I say, what do you mean? He says, well, we just left, right, a competing agency, because he was still doing his due diligence. Mm-hmm. And we saw your blow dryer up on the mantle. And I said, what do you mean you saw my blow dryer on the mantle? He says, yeah, we saw your blow dryer on the mantle. And the company tells me that you didn't design that blow dryer, and that you are an imposter, and that you're lying and you're making the story up. And I'm saying, oh my goodness, are you kidding? Not again. And so I offered to show him a copy of the patent, which I did. Back then we were still faxing, right? Everything was done by fax. So I faxed him a copy of my patent. Here it is, my name across the top, James Howard, Carol Dazzle Blow Dryer, a nice, beautiful rendering of the ink rendering of the patent on the front cover, the whole nine yards.
Yep.
This was the response that I got. He goes, well, you know what, James? I see you got the proof here, blah, blah, blah. He goes, but tell you the truth, I don't know who to believe. Now let that marinate for a moment. Even when you got the goods, and that has been, right, pretty much the script of our story over 400 years, even when you got the goods, still not good enough. And that just rubbed me in such a way, Josh, that I'm saying to myself, from moving forward, I am just not going to allow this image, this persuasion of the African-American creative being inferior to, and therefore not as credible as, their white counterparts. And that stuck with me. That drove me. This happened back in the early 90s, around 94. And ever since that moment, that's when I took to the lecture circuit of lecturing on the experiences of Black inventors, because it happened to me. I was discredited, and I showed the total proof that I was the only inventor of that product, and yet it wasn't good enough.
Yeah, I'm really sorry you had to go through all that, especially, someone who's an established inventor, it wasn't even your first patent, right?
No, it wasn't my first patent.
You had a track record, right?
Thank you. I did. I had already done the valve that I told you about. I had already done the lock that I told you about, and the paper towel dispenser. All of these were things that I had already proven. But yet when it comes down to having to make a decision on why would a competitor lie about this guy, and this competitor, by the way, I'm not going to give the name of the company, but this competitor was from New York, had been in business for over 30 years. And yet somehow, some way, they mistakenly thought that the blow dryer they had up on their mantle was theirs when it wasn't theirs. I won't even get into the details as to how they would go about mistaking my blow dryer. The important thing is that even with the proof, even with having the goods and the solid foundation and proof that you're the only inventor of that particular item, it still wasn't good enough. And my friend, I can assure you that that has happened countless times over the past 400 years to inventors and innovators of my persuasion. You just don't, the credibility, the acceptance thereof. And who knows, Josh, it may just give some justification for just why I never did contact Time magazine the way I planned on. But it might just give some justification for why in this big, thick article that they do, special feature magazine they do on 100 top innovators and inventors in this country, not a single one in there was Black except two, who, as I told you before, were in the bottom right-hand corner in very small captions, and each one of them could pass for white. So to me, that's like adding insult to injury, that even when we are recognized, you know, that there can be just some perception, you know what I'm saying? Some perception of, that darker melanin just not being equated and connected to the innovative pipeline. And it's just so true. And this is why I'm motivated to open up the Black Inventors Hall of Fame, the Museum of STEAM Learning Center.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're going to be, I think you're going to change the pages.
Thank you.
On the magazine.
I hope so. I really hope so. I appreciate that, Josh.
James, you've been really generous with your time. Can I ask you two more questions?
By all means, please do.
Okay. So earlier, you know, in the discussion, I mentioned you did a documentary, I think in 21, it looked like it was based on some of the filming. It looked like you were dealing with the more difficult elements of the pandemic for logistics, for sure. So your documentary, Black Inventors Got Game, you had all of these, you know, incredible inventors in one place. I mean, just to name a couple, it was, you know, Lonnie Johnson was there, inventor of the Super Soaker and Nerf gun, over 300 billion worldwide sales. You had Ken Johnson there, the inventor of Phase 10, which, as I understand, is the second most popular selling card game of all time. It had a really, really great collection of individuals, you know, all together in one place at one time. Two-part question. First, how cool was that? And second, as a, you know, a lifelong student and teacher, I'm sure you were taking notes. What were your big takeaways from hanging out with those guys?
Oh, man. First of all, it was great. I was floating on clouds, man. And on that great day, I had the pleasure of actually greeting each one of these men at the airport as they came in. And I wanted that to be the beginning of the storyline. And these are pioneers. These are unknown, short of Lonnie, these are unknown pioneers in the toy and game industry that have done groundbreaking work for that industry. And just to bring them all together, that equated with like that great picture that they have in Harlem, you know, of the great Renaissance, where all these jazz musicians are sitting on the stairs, you know, coming together. We all came together. And this is why I call that documentary that you're referring to as The Gathering, right? And we just had a conversation that was so, so important. And the biggest takeaway from that, there are so many, but one you have already mentioned, and that was from my good friend, Lonnie Johnson, who admonishes parents, right, to see in your child what they can be and what you see they will be, right? So my biggest takeaway is that each and every one of these young men, as I told their stories and as I subsequently put a camera in front of all of them and gathered their stories, that there was this seed of creative rebellion, right?
Sure. You know,
John Couch refers to it as creative rebellion. There's this seed of creative rebellion that the parents were fortunate enough to lay witness to, and they saw, and almost all of these guys' parents went on to encourage them, right? Not to dissuade this type of creative rebellion, but to encourage it. And this is why we end up with a Lonnie Johnson and a Ken Johnson and Elliot Eddy and Amont Morris, all because their parents saw in them what they can be. And what they saw, these guys became. So, and overall, it was just a great experience. We are going to be doing, I don't mind letting your audience know, but I will be trying to put together a Gathering 2.
Oh, great.
And the Gathering 2 is going to include female pioneers, Black pioneers in the toy and game industry. So I have to get a bigger room.
Sure.
A larger room, and I'll have more visits to make at the airport. So it's going to be exciting.
It is. One of my favorite stories in it, because I'm pretty sure, yeah, I'm very confident it was Lonnie, was talking about how he was experimenting, was trying to make rocket fuel in his mom's kitchen, almost caught the kitchen on fire, and he was really worried. He was really worried about dad coming home and whooping him, so he put on a second pair of pants. He's terrified. Dad's coming home. And his dad just calmly says, "Son, you need to start doing this outside," and buys him like a portable hot plate so he can actually do the experimentation outside. And it's like, Parents, if you take nothing else from listening to this, like let that story sink in.
Let that story sink in, man. And each one of these brothers had that level of storytelling that they could do. And it just made it a worthwhile moment for me as a film producer. And it was just amazing. So, yes, I would encourage your audience to definitely go on YouTube and look at the video. It's called The Gathering. It's just an amazing, amazing project.
I will be. I will for sure be including a link in the show notes to that too, so folks will have a
click on
directly. So my final question is just so the Black Inventors Hall of Fame is currently virtual, so folks can go and check it out online. Be a link in the show notes for that too. But as you mentioned, physical presence is in the works. Mm-hmm. How's that coming, and how can folks help out?
Excellent. It's coming along great. What I will call swimmingly, literally. We have decided on West Orange. And West Orange is also the place where Thomas Edison last had his innovation manufacturing facility. Cool. So our museum will be just up the road from Thomas Edison's museum. And it's going to be 38,000 square feet and all the other components that I told you it was going to be. So what we're doing right now is we're in a major fund drive. You know, we're doing a major fund drive gala that's going to be called Taking Flight. And we're borrowing the story of Charles Frederick Page. I've already mentioned him. We're borrowing his inspiration. We're riding around a gala for that. We're targeting $10 million on that fundraising. And then we have also been approved for funding from the state, which we're supposed to be on the budget for this year to garner funds for a capital building program. And I have been pledged by an African-American inventor who has countless patents and has made lots and lots of money franchising from his patents. He has pledged $13 million to the project.
That's incredible.
So we're really on a good pace to have this museum built by late 2026. And so that's what we're targeting, late 2026. And if anyone in the listening audience would like to help contribute, if you go to our website, there'll be a page there where you can go right to programs and support the initiative, because all of that is so key and so vital to having the capacity to continue to push forward and make sure that this project comes to full fruition.
It's wonderful. And, we talk a lot about, my partner and I, we talk a lot about utilizing a talent stack. Like what's the unique set of attributes that you have that you can combine together that differentiate you from almost everyone else? And I just think it's really cool how you're channeling yours, into this museum, the historical background met with the industrial design strengths, and even your penchant for film. I just can't wait to see how that all sort of manifests, in one place. Like what a great way to channel your interests and passions and abilities, all into one direction like that. It's really cool.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. In the fabled words of Pablo Coelho in The Alchemist, he says to put your desires and your wishes out there, and the entire universe will conspire to help you achieve them. And that's what I'm doing now. And I know that will happen. Those are the laws of attraction. And it's just a matter of time for this grand project is there for the world to see and benefit from.
I don't think we could end on more powerful words than that. So
thank you.
That was perfect. Thank you. Thank you, James. Really, really, really appreciate it. Want to keep the conversation going. Be happy to have you back on when you guys launch or talk about another film. So love to keep the conversation going, and thanks for all the work you're doing.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Josh.
All right, that's all for today, folks. Thanks for listening, and remember to check us out at aurorapatents.com for more great podcasts, blogs, and videos covering all things patent strategy. And if you're an agent or attorney and would like to be part of the discussion, or an inventor with a topic you'd like to hear discussed, email us at podcast@aurorapatents.com. Do remember that this podcast does not constitute legal advice, and until next time, keep calm and patent on.